You're listening to WTUL New Orleans. This is the News and Views Show. We're here today with Naomi Alexis. She moved here from New York a couple of years ago after a situation involving her brother that involved untreated serious mental illness. And Naomi has been incredibly impacted, as has her family. So welcome, Naomi.
Thank you for having me.
So Naomi, thank you so much again for being here and being willing to share your story. I know how incredibly difficult it must have been for you after the shooting in the military base where 13 people, including your brother, died.
Yes.
And so what happened with Aaron? Did he have a long history of mental illness? Tell us about your brother, your situation.
He had a long history of symptoms of mental illness. He's never, to my knowledge, been diagnosed or seen by a mental health physician or caregiver in any capacity, as far as I know. He exhibited all kinds of symptoms growing up, and I often brought it to my parents' attention, asking them, you know, did they think that this was behavior that should go overlooked, that should go, you know, ignored, that you should continue to allow. He was violent.
So what sort of symptoms was he exhibiting?
He was violent towards myself and my sister.
Violent physically? Physically violent. Emotionally? Yeah. Physically?
Yeah. I had my first black eyes and concussions from my older brother. I had oftentimes to pull him off of my younger sister, who was 6 years older than. There was also a lot of sexual inappropriateness, public masturbation, things that, you know, things that are not normal and things that, you know, were obvious signs that there was something wrong.
Right. Interestingly, that's not uncommon amongst people with serious mental illness. You hear a lot of probation and parole officers talking about people in their offices and social workers when they go to see their clients or their clients go to see them, and there's this issue of masturbation. So that is definitely something to watch for.
Yeah.
What kinds of things you would warn your parents?
Yeah, I mean, at some point it became obvious the furniture would be stained and I would be like, Mom.
Right.
What do you think this is? Can we do something about it?
Right.
And, you know, really all she did was strip the couch cushions, wash them, and put them back on again. And at that point, I was like, but it's, you just gave him a fresh canvas. It's the behavior that needs to be addressed, not the furniture. And, you know, it just continued. I left for college, and he was still trying to graduate from high school.
So how old was he at that time? Well, how old was he when you really started to notice something was wrong?
Here's the thing. I can remember periods of being very young and knowing that something was wrong. I'm talking about 6, 7, 8. And my parents...
And what's your age difference?
He's 2 years older than me. He was 2 years older than me.
Okay. And you also have a sister?
Yes, she's 4 years younger than me. So it's him, me, and then my younger sister. When I was about 7 or 8, my dad took my brother up north. At that point, we lived in Georgia with my grandparents. Just for a brief period, but I just remember there was a period where he was separated from us due to some inappropriate behavior. And this was very young. This was between the ages of 6 and 9. And then our family reunited up north again, and I can't say that the behavior stopped, but I can say that it might have subsided. And then when it became clear that my brother's behavior, there was some inappropriateness going on. And I have vague memories of, like, people walking in on us and being like, you're not supposed to be doing that. But this was very young. I was 6, and so he couldn't be more than 8.
And your sister, maybe she was a bit too young?
It's funny because I talked to her about Aaron, and she does not remember. I mean, she remembers when he was violent in high school, but she doesn't remember the parts when we were younger that I can remember. Because she's 4 years younger than me. So if I was 6, she was a toddler.
Right. And so you're not sure if your parents ever sought help for him?
I'm 100% sure that they didn't.
Okay.
Unfortunately.
Right.
Even when my dad separated my brother from us at that young age, I don't think it was to go see a doctor. I think it was just to talk to him, as if talking to him was going to cure him or make things better or
right.
st- stem whatever, you know, repercussions there were from his behavior, which is unfortunately not the case, obviously. It just continued to get worse.
And what about the school, his school teachers? Was there any intervention when he was...
I think if we had been stable, mm-hmm. there might have been some continuous observation of his symptoms. Mm-hmm. But we moved almost every year. So we never stayed in one school long enough for any teacher or guidance counselor to get a hold on what was wrong with his behavior.
Right.
Because I remember very young, when we were in Georgia and being in the first grade and coming into the hall, we went to the same schools occasionally because we're only 2 years apart. I remember walking down the hall with my classroom and seeing my brother sitting in a desk outside in the hallway. So there were behavioral problems from very young. It just never got, and because we moved so often, it was never addressed in any kind of significant way. Nobody ever said, there's a pattern of behavior here. They never got a hold of, you know, because we changed schools every year, every 2 years. We really never went to one school longer than 2 years.
So how old was Aaron when he joined the Navy? Your father was in the military?
Or? No, my mom's family is Navy. My grandfather was in the Navy, my uncle's in the Navy, my cousin's all in the Navy. Mm-hmm. So my mom, there was an incident with my brother. He bought himself a one-way ticket to Thailand and stranded himself there, basically. So he, for some woman he met online or something, silly like that, which is not...
It's always a woman. Or a man, right?
Or whoever, I don't know. Like, I don't know the full details of the story, except that he needed a way to get back. Mm-hmm. And he had abandoned everything, his apartment, his car, his job, to go to Thailand. So he had nothing to go back to at that point either. So my dad wound up having to find a way to get him out of Thailand. And he came back and stayed in New York, because he was in Seattle before that. And... he had an episode staying with my dad right after he got back from Thailand where he called the police because the neighbors upstairs were making too much noise at like 3 o'clock in the morning, and the police came and the apartment upstairs was empty. There was nobody there.
Wow.
So my dad at that point, I believe, tried to get some intervention for him. Mm-hmm. I think it was obvious at that point because there had been an incident before with a gun and a neighbor in Seattle where he had to bail him out of jail. Mm. And I think it became obvious to my dad at that point, but this was 28. He's got to be in his late 20s at this point, mid to late 20s, that this was symptoms of something, you know, serious.
Yeah, now, and he had joined the Navy. How old was he when he joined the Navy?
I think the cutoff point is like 28 or 29. Okay. For all armed services.
So it was before he was...
He was mid-20s at the latest.
It's interesting that they wouldn't have... that the military wouldn't have identified
Everybody
his illness.
Everybody says this to me, and I am so shocked myself. When he got into the Navy, I was blown over. I could not believe that he passed whatever screening they have for mental health. I mean... I knew that my family was in denial. Mm-hmm. That I could understand, because they loved him. He was the only son. Mm-hmm. He was the firstborn. They don't want to know that he has mental illness. They want him to get by. They want him to get a job and be stable. If he has an illness, obviously, they'd rather not acknowledge it. But for the military to have faulty screen... I mean, because I was shocked that they were going to allow him near a gun at some point. Like, any arms at all.
Sure.
I could not believe it. I knew he was violent. You know, that my family couldn't accept it and thought I was a drama queen was fine. But, like, for the Navy to not recognize that there was something wrong, it kind of unseated me. I was like, what? Is my judgment that off that I think that something is wrong and nobody else is seeing this? And at some point, I just was like, what can I do? I can't call the Navy and be like, you're wrong.
Right. Well, you probably could call them and tell them that, but I doubt if they would listen
exactly.
to you. Just, like, doctors don't listen to parents either. And
right.
Psychiatrists don't listen to loved ones, and you know, that is an ongoing problem.
Yeah.
Were you and Aaron close when you were growing up?
When we were really small, yeah. I mean, when we were kids, sure. But they became a distance when I realized that there was something inappropriate about his behavior, and that became obvious to me, like I said, when I was in elementary school, and I was like,
yeah.
And our parents would catch us doing things that we should not have been doing. And I was like, OK, okay, something's wrong.
Right.
But I didn't know what, you know, at that age, you don't know what the name of it is. You don't know how to name it. You don't know.
No, you
You just know how your brother. Right.
You have experiences, you don't have anything to compare it to.
Right.
So
he was my brother. And it's funny because we had a family reunion when I was about 20, right after he joined the Navy. And he surprised everybody by showing up at my grandparents' church. And, like, my initial response, though I had a lot of resentment towards him for everything that happened, even though, it, you know, it's not really his fault, my initial response was to run and wrap my arms around his neck. And I look back on that all the time and be like, And I think to myself, my base instinct was to love him because he was my brother. But there was so much wrong with everything around our relationship that it's so conflicting. I don't know how to feel about it.
So he and he came back from Thailand, and then
that's when he joined the Navy because
he joined the Navy.
My dad tried to have some intervention for him, some mental health intervention, and my parents had been divorced for a long time, so. There was a huge tug of war between what should happen with Aaron. And my mom was like, he just needs to join the Navy. So she gave him that chance. She said, this is your last chance to do something with your life. Join the Navy. And she thought that was going to solve his problems. I don't know how she thought that was going to solve his problems, but that's what she wound up convincing him that he had no choice but to, because he had abandoned his job and his life in Seattle to go to Thailand. He came back to nothing, and he had the incident with my dad. My dad tried to intervene with mental health help of some kind, and my brother ran to my mom. And my mom, of course, because there's the schism between my parents, mm-hmm. was like, okay, well, we'll just join the Navy.
And your mom, again, not really realizing the severity of his symptoms.
I have to say, I find that to be astonishing. My mother's a registered nurse.
Oh, no. What kind of nursing does she do?
She's, right now, she works at Bellevue Hospital. I don't know if you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
She's got a huge psych ward.
Yeah.
She hasn't worked there forever, but yeah. She was born there.
Wow. So you were surprised that she didn't recognize Aaron's symptoms of illness?
I was surprised and brought it to her attention frequently. I guess they really just thought, my mom used to say things like, I wish you guys would just get along. I guess she really thought we were just fighting siblings, like there was some kind of rivalry. But I was like, it's unprovoked. I'm not. Right. And she, because she was working all the time, she never saw the initiation of the physical abuse. She only saw the aftermath. So she just assumed that because I got a scratch in every once in a while trying to defend myself, that I was also, that we had some kind of, I don't know, that we were fighting on some equal basis. I was like, first of all, he's 6'2" and I'm 5'4". I'm not stupid. I'm not fighting someone that big for no reason.
Right.
So she didn't understand that it wasn't some equal thing where we came at each other. He just would come into the room and initiate physical violence.
Did you ever think that he would be capable of committing the crime that he later committed when he returned from Thailand on the military base? After having gone through the experience you went through with him growing up, where he would exhibit violence?
I didn't know what he was capable of, honestly. And I knew from my experience with his violence that it was there was more.
Yeah.
And I don't know what kept him from doing worse damage than he did to myself and my sister, other than like immediate repercussions. I don't even know if he could consider those, honestly.
Sure.
But when that morning, I listened to NPR on a regular basis every morning, and I was listening to the show that I always listened to at 10 o'clock in New York, on WNYC, and they broke the show for this news update about a gunman at a Navy Yard in D.C., and my sister walked into the room at that point, and the first thing we said was, wouldn't it be crazy if that was Aaron? This is not outside the realm of possibility for us.
Yeah, got you.
At all.
Got you on that.
My sister, 3 weeks before that, before the incident happened. In August of 2013, my mom got a call from the HR department of his job. And they said, this was a company that used to send him around the country for different IT jobs. I don't remember the name of the company, but they called and said that he was exhibiting. HR department of the company he worked for called my mom 3 weeks before the final incident happened and said that they'd had to send him home due to he was exhibiting some paranoid behavior, and they were hoping that she would talk to him and get him to see some, because I don't know what the HR department, what can the HR department do? They can't fire you because you're mentally ill, because that would, you could get sued for that. So they called my mom and she called him, and I don't know what happened during that conversation. I don't know what she said to him. She told him that he needed to go talk to someone. I think he went to the VA hospital, but he never told them anything other than, I'm not having trouble sleeping. But it had become obvious after the incident happened that he was exhibiting some very paranoid behavior, and the police were called and what have you.
So this all came out after.
No, yeah, that when he got sent home, it came out after, like what the details of the incident were, the reason he got sent home from the assignment. But right after that phone call happened, when my mom called my brother and tried to talk to him, my sister was in the other room in tears, and I was like, "What's going on? Why are you crying like this?" And she said, she had visited my brother when he lived in Texas and was staying in an apartment, and he had an incident with a neighbor upstairs where she said that he used to confront her all the time in the parking lot and complain about the noise that she used to make upstairs. This is a continuing theme for him, noise upstairs that he can't place, or he thinks it's a neighbor, calls the police, what have you, and there's nobody there. He's hearing things, obviously. Right. He's exhibiting some symptoms of auditory hallucinations. Sure. And so he, at some point, shot through his ceiling with a gun. And she called the police, the neighbor, obviously. And he convinced the police that he was cleaning the gun, it was an accident. But when my sister went to go visit, he admitted to her that he was trying to kill her. So I had no doubt that my brother was capable of. And when she told me this, when my sister told me, crying, while my mom's on the phone with him talking about going to see a therapist because the HR department is called, concerned about him, I said to my sister, "Did you tell anyone? Have you spoken?" I just don't understand the denial that everybody seems to be. Everybody's getting little snips, little obvious glances into his symptoms, and no one is doing anything about it. And I just couldn't understand. I was like, he used to call and leave rambling messages on all of our voicemails that were so incoherent and scary. And I was like, did you get a message from your brother, from your son? Did you hear? Do you see? I just couldn't understand. And every time something happened, my dad would be like, "Why didn't you tell me?" And I'd be like, "You say that every time. You say, why didn't you tell me every time something happens?" And I'm like, why do I have to tell you when you can see it for yourself? You're asking me to tell you something that you can see. I called you when he was violent. I called you in the middle of it. And you pretended like nothing was going on. And he said, "Oh, that was just sibling rivalry." And I was like, up until 3 months before it happened, he was asking me why I didn't have a relationship with my brother. And I was telling him very honestly that he was violent. Right. And scary, and nobody took it seriously. Right. And he was like, "That's just sibling rivalry." And I was like, "I really promise you, it's not. It is absolutely not."
Yeah, I wish, looking back, obviously, your parents had listened more seriously and maybe sought some sort of intervention for him, right. Which is probably what he and others like him need. So, there's federal legislation, which is actually what really brought up you and I together,
right.
Through DJ Jaffe, who runs mental illness policy, and you had reached out to him after you heard him on NPR speaking about a similar situation, mm-hmm. to what your brother experienced. What was it that inspired you to call? What was it that you heard that motivated you to reach out to DJ and want to help?
Well, he was talking specifically about a law that was passed.
Kendra's law?
Yes.
The assisted outpatient treatment law.
Yes. And I
was going to ask you about that because it seems like in Aaron's situation, that's exactly what he would have benefited from.
Well, I think it would have...
For stabilization.
Right. It would have benefited him if he had kept still. Unfortunately, he had so many incidents in different states. Okay. And if those states were obviously, if there's some kind of federal database of information, then it could have helped. But because he was in Seattle, and then he was in Texas, and then he was in New York when all these things happened, it's hard to know.
And Thailand.
Right, and Thailand. It's hard to know if those, if there was any kind of federal net that catches all of those incidents and could report it to some kind of...
That's interesting. That's something that in a conversation with somebody at Probations and Parole here in New Orleans, they have... They are able to treat homeless people and get them their medications, but if they're not in an involuntary situation, they have no way to keep track of individuals when they go missing or move to other states. So that is a piece of the puzzle that I wonder about myself. Mm-hmm. Even with assisted outpatient treatment, if a person isn't under the care and guidance of their parents or a social worker or in a housing situation, how do we stop them from running away? And how do we follow them if they do and bring them back?
Right.
And assisted outpatient treatment also, for listeners that maybe don't know what it is mandated medication where the person is able to remain in the community, live in the community, either with a family member in a housing situation, but that if they refuse to take their medication or don't know that they're sick mm-hmm. and refuse to take their medication, the law allows for that person to be taken to the hospital to receive medication and then returned back to home or wherever it is that they're living. And in New Orleans, or in Louisiana, our assisted outpatient treatment law is Nicola's law.
Okay.
And it's modeled after Kendra's law. Every state except for four, it's either three or four in the United States, have some sort of assisted outpatient treatment law. And they're mostly modeled after Kendra. So in California, it's Laura's law.
Okay.
So the law, in my opinion, it's definitely helpful in stabilizing a person. It doesn't provide aftercare for the person. It doesn't allow them to enter into a community outpatient primary care treatment that has some sort of continuum that follows their discharge plan, which is part of the broken system. The system is broken at every step of the way. So we're really lacking for long-term inpatient support systems or long-term support systems in general, like hospital care, like the inpatient care we had at Charity Hospital wasn't perfect, but it was definitely a system that worked,
right.
That needed improving, that didn't involve law enforcement and the criminal justice system. So after Katrina closed, we lost those 128 beds. We basically went from 128 beds to zero overnight. And which meant that all those people that had utilized Charity Hospital for mental illness then were channeled into the criminal justice system. But the system is broken also in terms of outpatient primary care. We don't have enough social workers. We don't have enough psychologists. We don't have enough psychiatrists. We don't have enough wraparound services that connect together. I proposed a plan for Charity Hospital that's a one-stop shop, which means that a person could go, be stabilized, get into some sort of transitional housing situation where at that facility they would be able to participate in wellness programs, holistic health, psychotherapy, whatever other programs are needed, and then be transitioned back into community when they're ready. So it would be like a step down.
Right.
Program, so that eventually, hopefully, when a person's stable enough, they'd be able to return to the community to live, work, and do what other people do. People do when they're not sick.
Right.
Some people, unfortunately, never get better. We have to provide for people like that too,
yeah.
Outside of solitary confinement in prison
right.
and jails,
of course.
And then I also the facility is huge, so the abandoned hospital. So I also was proposing to use a quarter of the space for research. You know, for we need better medications.
Absolutely.
We need better research to maybe help find ways that people don't have to take medications, because it's medications people don't like to take them because they make them feel bad. And then they're off their medications, they get into that downward spiral where they're not able to get out of it.
Right.
So it's, again, it's this huge broken thing. So DJ Jaffe has been pushing for a bill, federal legislation, that is focused on the most seriously ill. So we know that more needs to be done for all people with mental illness, whether it's mental wellness, a mental illness, or serious mental illness. But his focus is really on people like your brother, because they're the ones that have always been the most ignored. We don't know what to do, so we warehouse them. We warehouse them in dungeons, then we later on warehouse them in state asylums, and then we decided that that was inhumane, so we closed the state, and uneconomical. I mean, realistically, let's be real. The reason they closed the state hospitals was because of economic issues. It wasn't really a humanitarian thing. And now then we let them out and didn't provide any. We didn't provide for ways to absorb people back into our community. So now they're being put into jails and prisons or housing. So, but housing without enough services.
Right.
So if you just put a person in a house and you don't offer them services, treatment, care they need to get back on their feet, then you're still warehousing. So anyway, this is definitely it's a serious epidemic. There are 4 million Americans have untreated serious mental illness. We deal with other epidemics immediately. Zika, what was the one before Zika, the mosquito-borne virus. But why can't we deal with the epidemic of mental illness the same way that we deal with other epidemics?
That's a very good question. I've been thinking about the stigma of mental illness for a long time. I suffer from depression. I mean, it mostly has a lot to do with having a brother who was physically abusive. But, you know, I might have had it even if I didn't. Who knows?
I think we all have. I have some issues with depression, not serious.
Right.
It's not chronic.
Right, mine's not chronic either. It's situational, typically. Mm-hmm. And I think the problem is people are afraid of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand being afraid of it, because you really don't know. Like I said, I didn't know what my brother was capable of for a very long time. I'm seeing his violence firsthand. I didn't know that he would ever... It was surreal when it happened. Go ahead, baby. When his final incident, you know, happened, it was surreal. But it wasn't outside the realm of possibilities for me at all. So I think that mental illness is scary or has a stigma because people are frightened of it. It's so... I mean, the symptoms can be so benign, but they can also be very obvious. They can also be, you know, painful. So I think that people just... I think if people... And they can be... I mean, you can see them in everyone. You know what I'm saying?
And what is... needed, I think, is early intervention.
Yeah,
that's part of it, you know. But unfortunately, because we're so far gone, we're so far away from that. The epicenter of the crisis is jails and prisons. You know, the people are there, and we have to deal with the people. People like your brother, who got to the stage way past early intervention, that needed. Something that consisted of outpatient treatment, something involuntary. You know, hopefully we'll get to the stage, you know, at some point in the future where we can prevent people from getting so far gone.
Yeah.
We can prevent people from getting to the point where your brother was at, and people who are in jails and prisons, people who are living under bridges, and people who end up taking their own lives or completing suicide. I mean, obviously we can't control all of that. And there's a formula, you know, where they say when you're dealing with medical issues, you always have a third that get better, a third that don't get better but continue to live, and then the third that don't make it. So, but you know what? It's worth it to deal with the third, the two-thirds that can get
absolutely
there. And you, if you had any advice to give to folks who maybe are in the same situation that you're in, or maybe not there yet, but approaching a situation like what you've been through. And by the way, you left New York, really, to get away from what might have been a really negatively impactful situation for you, with people constantly hounding you for media stories and that sort of thing. And that's something else that people don't understand, right? When things like this happen, how it really affects the family.
Yeah. My advice is don't be afraid to talk to someone, even if the symptoms are minor. Like if you just don't understand why your kid is behaving a certain way, just talk to someone. Talk to them about what you see. Talk to them about why you think it's, you know, outside the realm of healthy behavior. It doesn't have to be, you know, it doesn't have to get to the point of violence for you to take a step towards counseling. I'm in therapy. I don't think anybody should be afraid to say that I talk to someone about my mental health. I think if you go to a doctor for your physical health, there's nothing wrong with going to a doctor for your mental health. And if you need drugs, then you try the drugs. If they don't work, you try other drugs. If you don't like the drugs, try other treatments. You don't ignore it. Don't be afraid to talk. There should not be a stigma about talking to someone about your mental health. I mean, we all feel crazy sometimes. Everyone feels frazzled or frustrated or angry. There's nothing wrong with putting a name to those feelings and talking to a mental health provider. There's absolutely nothing wrong with it. Everybody has anxiety about things, whether it's, you know, debilitating anxiety or, you know, functional anxiety. It's just how comfortable you feel living with it. Like, does it affect your life? And if it affects your other children or your other family members, then you know that you need to take responsibility for it and talk to someone. And I don't think that there's anything wrong with that. And I wish more people felt that way.
Is there, you've been in New Orleans now 2 years. It's hot. To get this hot in New York.
Soup.
Have you found, has it been difficult to find therapy services for mental illness or mental health issues?
I actually have found...
You're shaking your head no.
No, so I haven't had any problems actually on my own.
That's really encouraging.
Yeah, no, it is. I actually have someone comes to my house once a week and we talk. And I go to, I see a...
Is that covered by insurance?
It is covered by my Medicaid, yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Completely covered by my Medicaid, so I'm excited.
Was that before the state began the Medicaid expansion on July the 1st?
This was recent. I started seeing my therapist here in February.
Okay, January, so at the beginning of the year, that's when the state was... When they expanded Medicaid to allow for Medicaid to pay for mental health care. Mm-hmm. So I'm not... I mean, before that, I know the charity being closed and all of the other traditional systems that people in New Orleans knew had really had a lot of difficulty finding treatment and care that they needed. Mm-hmm. And it seems, and I don't know if it's true, but I've heard the health director speak about this, who says that in the Black community, there is more stigma than in other communities in not wanting to admit or accept a mental health problem.
It's funny because there are comedians who make jokes about it, like how in Black families you just have that crazy uncle or that crazy cousin. And I have a crazy uncle, and he's paranoid schizophrenic, and it's not a joke. And I don't know why... I spent a summer visiting my grandmother in Seattle when I was about 14 years old, and my dad called my grandmother and said, "You have to make sure he's locked up before I bring my kids there." And I was like, why is that the only option, to have him put in jail before we spend a summer? And then I spent the entire summer scared out of my mind that he was going to come, because they had to replace a door frame. He had ripped off of his hinges right on the back of the house, and my bedroom faced the door. And I spent the entire summer, like, watching that door, waiting for him to come and rip it right out of the wall again, because I was afraid of my uncle. I didn't know you know, I don't know at 14 how to interact with him because he's not around. And if you say that he's dangerous, and they had to repaint one of the rooms because he tried to make gold burning something in the bedroom, and I'm like, as a 14-year-old, it's so frightening to hear these things and not understand that he was mentally ill, and that the solution is not to put him in jail for the summer. Why is that the solution?
It's
funny because I watched the immediate news coverage after my brother's incident. One of my ex-boyfriends works for NPR, and he had met my brother and my mother's ex-husband, who obviously knew my brother, and they both were like, I couldn't understand how they could say that they never, that they didn't understand where this came from, that it was unexpected. I couldn't, because I confided in my boyfriend at the time. I was, you know, late teens, early 20s, you know, that his behavior was violent, inappropriate my entire life. And so for him to be on the radio and say things like, it was unexpected, I just couldn't. I was like, how can you say that? After the things that I told you, right, it was really shocking. And then my stepfather, who I think the last time that he communicated with Aaron was about a shotgun. I just was like, how can you possibly say that you're surprised? How can you possibly be surprised? When you, I mean, it was, just, I could not. The denial is unfathomable. It is shocking to me. And I don't understand what the point of the denial is. It didn't get anyone anywhere at any point. Right. Like, it helped no one. Right. The denial before or the denial after. It's not helping. For people who also witness other people's mental illness symptoms, don't deny that these things are problematic. Don't deny that they are symptoms of some greater problem. They need to be treated. They need to be diagnosed. You know, my brother was not, I don't even know what his diagnosis would have been. I don't think he was ever treated with anything, or by anyone. So I don't think he was ever specifically diagnosed with any kind of mental illness. Obviously, he said he had paranoid symptoms. He was clearly a little psychotic. I like, you know, it's hard to say what it is because it was after the fact.
Yeah.
Nobody really had a chance to ever diagnose him.
Right, and I think another issue is the HIPAA rules, perhaps some protection rules that don't allow a patient's information to be shared with the family. So that makes it even more difficult for family members to really know what's happening. And, you know, it's a sticky problem or issue because, you know, in general it works. But when, for people who are in delusional states or incapacitated for some reason or another, or even people who have physical trauma and can't speak, right, you know, families need to be informed. Not necessarily about the personal, you know, the case notes,
right?
Right? But about the medications that the person is supposed to be taking and when to take them. They pass caregiver laws all the time. There was one in the legislative session, the last legislative session before the budget session, and a state senator passed, helped get a caregiver's law passed that allows for a patient's family to help with their discharge by knowing what medications are supposed to take and so on. So for a person with dementia, Alzheimer's or whatever, you know, the family know how to help. But they don't have those kinds of laws for people with mental illness who are think that their family's trying to kill them.
Right.
They have conspiracy theories that the CIA or the aliens have sent them. No, do not share my information with my family. They're so, you know. So, you know, there's this, and there are, it's got to be a way. I mean, there are situations where it's true, not everybody is nice. There are situations where families are abusive toward their mentally ill loved ones and would rather see them in jail or in a mental hospital than have to deal with the situation. And so there have to be safeguards built into privacy laws that do not allow information to be shared with a family member who's harmful. And that largely is up to the discretion of the psychiatrist or the you know, attending physician. So, but, you know, we need to do something. We can't just stop not doing anything.
Right.
And now is the time, and it's exciting that this legislation it will have already passed by the time this interview is aired. It's up for a vote July the 6th, is Wednesday. Mm-hmm. And it's expected to pass through the House with no opposition or very little opposition. Then it has to conference with the Senate and be signed into law by the President. It's expected that that will happen, but it's only a first step. So there's going to be an enormous amount of work to do after that to continue to work with these privacy rules, federal grant money that's distributed to states for people with mental illness. You know, traditionally, money has gone to agencies that treat people with less severe symptoms, so anxiety or depression or ADD or ADHD, which is important, but nothing for people with bipolar disease, serious chronic depression, or schizophrenia. Or very little. Mm-hmm. So we'll have to watch. I mean, there's provisions in the bill that are meant to make sure that a doctor is, you know, doling out the money rather than a lawyer or somebody that may have a substance abuse issue but doesn't know anything about serious mental illness. It's going to require a lot of transparency, accountability, and watchdog groups from community watchdog groups. You know, to make sure that what has been mandated by law to have an impact, a positive impact on serious mental illness, is really happening in communities. And that's going to require us, like you said, talking about it.
Right.
And sharing our experiences. And, you know, if something's not working, sharing that so that we can communicate that information through the various governmental channels, local, state, and federal, to make sure that laws are being complied with, and if they need to be changed, then we can change those laws as we move forward. But this bill is meant to provide for more hospital inpatient beds, which we know are sorely needed, because currently there are more people in jail than there are in state hospitals. It will provide funding for the assisted outpatient treatment law, which is kind of where we started this conversation, right, that would allow for, you know, a family member or a social worker to make sure that their client or family member is getting the medication they need in order to be stabilized. Again, it's not care, it's not aftercare, it's not, you know, it's not rehabilitation, it's stabilization.
Sure.
But we know, as you see in the case of your brother, how important it is just for a person to be stable. You know, and then they can start to make decisions and have insight into their disease. And if they don't think they have a disease, then there are other ways that people can work with that person. But you can't work with a person that isn't even stable, doesn't think they're sick, or doesn't know that they're sick.
Right.
So there's that, and then it also puts a physician, medical professional, at the head of SAMHSA, the agency that's meant to provide money to states for care. So, what, you know, I'm actually excited and hopeful. It's not, this bill isn't, it's been diluted since it was first introduced, so it's not as strong as we would have liked it to be, and some of us that are working on this would have liked it to be, but I'm so hopeful that at least now, I mean, you turn on the radio and you hear about mental illness. You know, people are telling their stories. Bills are passing. We're dealing at the criminal justice end of things. There's a whole bipartisan push to reduce mass incarceration.
Yeah.
So we know we can't talk about that unless we talk about mental illness, given that 60 to 70% of people in jails and prisons have some sort of mental illness or mental disability.
Yeah.
So this window is open, which I never thought I would see in my lifetime, where you have Republicans and Democrats coming together on these two issues, you know, mental health reform and reducing mass incarceration. And I think these things are politically possible. And so I think, you know, where we need to work on other issues that are right now not politically possible but important to us, we need to keep pushing for those things, but we should do the things that we should do and not, you know, play politics. Again, Naomi, thank you so much for sharing your story with us
Absolutely.
Today.
Absolutely, and I hope that the resources that this bill will make available will help people in situations like mine, and people who are afraid and don't know where to begin.
I hope it will as well, and I think that it will. And also want to invite you back anytime.
Thank you.
To continue this push for real mental health reform that so many people are in need of. And we'll definitely be following, you know, continuing to follow your story and the stories of so many people like you. But I can't thank you enough for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me. It's good to talk about.
All right. You're listening to WTUL New Orleans. This is the News and View Show. Stay tuned. Democracy Now! Is coming right up.